Hi, everybody. Welcome to this podcast on telling stories and leading change. I think you're in for a treat today. I'm going to be interviewing Lori Silverman, who's written a number of books. She's been co-author of a couple books called Critical Shift and Stories Trainers Tell, and her latest book is Wake Me Up When the Data is Over. I think that's a perfectly inspired title, and I absolutely love it, and I can picture meetings I've been in where that title has really been true. At any rate, she's a big fan of storytelling, and that's what we're going to talk about, and how storytelling can be used as a tool in leading change. So welcome, Lori.
Thank you very much.
Hey, as we get started, one of the things that I noticed as we were going back and forth getting ready for this call is that we both are a fan of David Gleicher's change formula. And for some of you listening, sometimes this formula gets attributed to Dick Beckhard, but it's really one of his graduate students, David Gleicher. And the way I think of it, and you might think of it a little bit differently, Lori, is that the equation is dissatisfaction with the status quo times vision times first steps equals successful change. And that equation is over top of R, which is resistance, saying that if any of those, that is dissatisfaction or vision or first steps, are missing, then resistance takes over and your change fails. Is that pretty much how you know that equation?
Yes, it's exactly the way that I know that equation. And if I might elaborate on it a little bit further, for me, the dissatisfaction piece has to do with what's the compelling reason for the change. So if I think about it from an individual perspective, it's really the answer to the question, so what? Why should I change, or why should the people in my group change? The dilemma with this is, especially in successful organizations, if you think of it in terms of a mountain range, imagine that people are standing on top of a mountain, and now someone has said to them, we need to go to that mountain over there, and points to a mountain that might be 100 miles in the distance. Well, for employees, not only do they have to climb the new mountain, but they first have to climb down from the old mountain. So that means we have a significant amount of work to do in terms of providing them with information that allows them to say, you know what, I really am dissatisfied with the way things are, and I really am interested in hearing if there's a new or different way of doing things. And then, as you said, from there, we have to provide them with a vision of what the change will look like. From my perspective, when we're talking about transformational change, you know, the most we may be able to provide people with up front is a view at the 40,000-foot level. And hopefully, as the change reveals itself and we become more informed, we're able to provide them with the path at 20,000 feet or even at the walking path level. And then finally, there is that issue of first steps. What do we need to do to begin? Now, the real challenge I think we have here is that this flies in the face of really good project management, because project managers are taught to outline every single step in a change, even if it's going to take 2 to 3 years to implement it. And as we know, as good change agents, that's just not something we can do, because we want to learn along the way. And so what that means is that we need to have an iterative learning process in place where we spell out what the first steps are, put them in place, learn from that, then step back, create the next several steps, and move forward.
Good. That makes perfect sense to me. And I love the image of the mountain and having to climb off of one mountain. So it's a great story to start off our conversation. So we agree that there needs to be dissatisfaction with the status quo, vision, and first steps, but why use stories? I mean, why not just do a massive PowerPoint presentation and give people all the data?
Well, you know, that's an excellent question. First of all, the mind does not operate, or the brain does not operate, according to Microsoft. The brain does not...
I'm sorry, I just choked on my coffee. I love that.
Well, the brain doesn't house information in list format. What it really loves is it loves visual images and patterns, because that's what it comprehends, that's what it remembers, and that's what it recalls with high degrees of accuracy when asked a question. So what we have to do is we have to provide those images and those patterns to people. And when we do that, we connect left and right brain thinking together. And when that happens, then we can get change at four levels, or we can impact people at four levels. We can impact them physically, because what we know through studies is that if I were to connect people to devices, medical devices that measured their blood pressure or their heart rate or their breathing, things like that, is that it profoundly shifts when they start to listen to a story. It slows down. Second, we touch them cognitively. You know, we can talk, and I'm a fast speaker, at maybe 150 words a minute, but the brain works, as you know, at 800 words a minute. So people are making meaning as they're listening to stories, and that's where the real power of stories are, independent of what you and I might say the true universal lesson of that story is about. Third, we know that stories touch people emotionally. And fourth, and I think this is where we need to go today with organizational change, I call it the human spirit. We must impact the human spirit. I think the challenge we have today is that emotions years ago used to be enough for change to take place. Today it's not. Today we have to give people goosebumps on their arms to make them compelled to really want to do something different. They have so many choices. Now, let me give you an example of how this all kind of gets put into play and what the outcomes can be. At Lockheed Martin Space Systems, Anastasia Walsh was asked by the president of the company to reduce the number of mishaps. Now, in an organization like Lockheed Martin, even one mishap is not good. So she went to work with the quality assurance department to study the way that they created their mishap reports. And what she noticed is that they were extremely technical. So, for example, you would see things like, we were on step 54A of process A, and someone turned the wrench the wrong way. And that's all people would get. So they didn't really understand the implication of these mishaps to themselves or to their own work groups. So what they decided to do in 2005 is they decided to take on a story format instead of the statistics. And the story format went something like this. They were doing a test and something happened, or they were doing a crane operation and a wire got jammed. And then from there, they would talk about what the potential crisis was, what was recognized or realized about the situation, and how it was stopped or fixed. Now, you might say, yeah, so? So what? They turned it into a story format. What were the results? Well, at the end of the first 10 months, they had had a significant drop in the number of mishaps, and in fact, were projecting a 76% decrease at the end of the first year of implementation. And on top of that, there was an increase in reporting of near misses by 39%.
Wow.
All by changing the way people communicated with each other.
So it might help listeners right now to get a picture, if you will, of what you mean by story as opposed to, you know, an example or an anecdote. Because I think you're talking about something much richer than just an anecdote that you might toss off.
You're absolutely right. You know, I always say that one of the real dilemmas in the field is that describing a situation is not the same as telling a story. And the other dilemma that we have is just the conversation that you and I are having today, we would call narrative, and we probably would label it as really good narrative, but not all narrative is a story. So let me give you some characterizations of what makes a story different from other forms of communication. First of all, a story has to have a plot. So there has to be some sort of obstacle or conflict that people are overcoming. And with that, there actually have to be characters, characters with names. Now, they don't have to be the names of the real people who engaged in the situation. For example, with the mishaps, they can be composite characters because it may not be comfortable for people to hear about an extremely specific situation that would implicate them individually. So sometimes we use composite characters, or they can be real people as well. Third.
Okay, actually, before you go on, and even when you're creating a composite character, you're giving that character a name,
absolutely,
like Bob or Mary.
Absolutely. You want to bring them to life. We need to humanize what it is that we're talking about. Because we talk so much in generalizations that it really doesn't make a difference.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So from there, the reason we want the characters is because the characters are going to have dialogue. And they're going to have two different types of dialogue. They're going to have the dialogue where we actually talk to each other in the story. And second, inner dialogue. What is it that they're thinking? And I always tell people, if you're not familiar with inner dialogue, take a little bit of time and watch a soap opera. You know, you'll have the heroine standing up against the door before she opens it, wanting to know if the man on the other side is really, truly in love with her. You know, and she's wiping her brow at the same time that she's asking herself a series of questions. But that's what we need it to include. And along with that, ideally, a story includes a universal lesson that is applicable to every single person who hears or reads it. Now, in that way, we bring to life a situation rather than just describing it. Because when we describe it as an example or an anecdote, what we do is we reduce it to a summary. And it doesn't have its impact anymore. That the people need in order for them to really find themselves in that situation or to say, wow, I could see that happening.
Hmm. Got it. That's good. I like that structure. Are there any other tips you might have on helping people structure a story? I think you've given a really nice broad outline, but I'm thinking of people who this might not be a natural thing for them.
Absolutely. You know, and I hear that a lot from people. My biggest rule of thumb is follow what's called the story arc. Stories have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And what happens in the beginning is when we kind of paint the picture. That's when we introduce our characters, we set the stage with some details, and we kind of gain context around the situation itself so that people know if it's important, you know, what time of day it is or what year it is or what might be going on in the situation. Then the middle of a story arc is really the conflict or the plot that moves to climax. So I don't care what you call it, whether you call it an obstacle, a conflict, an issue, a dilemma, a paradox, makes no difference to me. In fact, you may even want to exaggerate it. And there's the challenge in organizations. Most organizations want to sweep those issues underneath the rug. And they don't want people to know how bad it really is, when in fact that's what we need to compel people to do something different. And then finally, a story has to end. There has to be a resolution, except we do not live in the land of Disney. So the resolution isn't always positive, but there is an ending to the story. Now, I add two things to the end of stories that are important for me. First of all, I want to know what's the point of the story. Because if you can't tell me what the point of the story is, then I wonder why it is that you're sharing it with other people. Now, when I think about the point of the story, I think to myself, how can I summarize it in 7 to 9 really catchy words that people will remember that are positively stated? And the reason I do that is because, as we know, again, with the way the mind works, you know, if I tell someone who's golfing not to hit the ball in the water, and that's what they keep repeating to themselves, their mind will only hear, hit the ball in the water.
Right.
Because it takes out the negative. And once I have that key point, then what I do is I go back and restructure the story so that it fits that particular key point, because some stories have more than one key point. But I want the one that's universally going to resonate with every single person who hears it and is not going to offend a soul. And second, I want to know what the call to action is. Because, you know, as people hear stories or as they read them, they oftentimes can go, yeah, that's really nice, or yeah, I could see myself in that situation. But they often don't think to themselves, oh, my goodness, how does it apply to my life? And what does it mean to me? And so I think we have to add that call to action at the end of stories for people. Now, that call to action may change depending upon the audience, again, who's reading or hearing the story. But the rest of the story in and of itself pretty much stays the same, because as stories travel, we want people to be able to relay them in similar ways, especially within an organizational setting. Now, there is one thing that I tell people not to do, if I might just add a piece to this.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that is, when you're going to tell a story, do not use the words, let me tell you a story.
Really? Why not?
Well, because a lot of people think that you're going to move them to fairy tale land.
Huh.
And so there's still a lot of folks out there who question the viability of stories, which is why we did the book Wake Me Up When the Data is Over, because we have results for every single example we cite in the book, very tangible bottom line results. But yet there are still some people who say, you know, I'm not just a big fan of this yet, and it's
still not resonating with me. So you can lead into a story by saying, you know, that reminds me of a situation. Or I was thinking about this the other day, and as I reflected on some thoughts, here's what came to mind. There are many ways to lead into a story that are different from, let me tell you a story.
Yeah, that makes good sense. You know, and I would encourage anybody listening to this right now who might be skeptical of telling stories to just think back to the last couple presentations that you've heard and say, what do you remember? And often it's the story that somebody told, something that really stuck with you. I mean, I'll have people come up to me years after, you know, I did some presentation and say, oh, you know, I still remember that story you told about. And the example is so vivid, but they don't remember the 18 points that were on that ill-fated PowerPoint slide that I used to make. You know, and it's, so I think if we just draw on our own experience, we go, yeah, it's stories that we remember.
Well, and it's also the way we talk each and every day. So, you know, if you have a child who's coming home from school in the afternoon and you say to them, how was your day? Think about how do they respond. Or, you know, if someone walks into your office, what's going to follow the phrase, boy, you aren't going to believe what happened to me a few minutes ago. Both of those are going to lead, unless you have a teenager, so let's leave that out, you know, to stories that people want to share about their day. And you're absolutely correct. We just don't remember those lists. They don't resonate with the way our brain retains information.
Yeah. I want to actually go back to one part of the story arc, and that's the middle part. And you talked about how people will often want to sweep the negative stuff under the rug, and that's perfectly understandable. And in my work in change, I believe that seeing that urgency for change and feeling that urgency for change is absolutely essential. And so what I advise my clients to do is not sweep that stuff under the rug, and that there is a compelling reason why you've got to name that stuff so that people go, whoa. And, you know, and a lot of people in change talk about the birding platform. I think it came from Daryl Connor's work. And it occurred to me a couple of years ago, as much as I would say, oh, yeah, people need to see the burning platform, that really wasn't enough. And I work with a couple of companies down on the shipping channel in Houston. And you can see these platforms, these rigs out there. And if I'm sitting having coffee with one of my clients, let's say Larry, and we look out there and we see a burning platform, you know, I might say, hey, that thing looks like it's on fire. And he'll go, boy, it is. I think there's a number we ought to call. And he calls the number, and then we get back to our meeting and say, hey, you want to go get lunch? I mean, that was our level of commitment. But if Larry and I were standing on the platform, it would be a very different experience. And I think the kind of stuff that gets swept under the rug is often the kind of stuff that makes people feel like we're standing on that platform and we better do something right now.
Absolutely. And I love the word that you used, which is that it brings within people a sense of real urgency.
Yeah.
It's like, why is this important? And why is this important right now?
Yeah.
Because, you know, we all have multiple priorities, whether it be at work or at home. And so what I want to know is that how is it going to get to the top? And how is it going to grab my attention to make me want to do something different?
We could sit here and go, yeah, all day long because we agree with each other. But, yes, absolutely. So do you have I know one of the things we talked about in preparing for this is that there's a pretty major example kind of throughout the life of a pretty big change that use stories throughout to help move things along. Did I get that right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So I think this would be a great time to hear about that.
Wonderful. Let me lay a little bit of context, and then I'll talk about the example in terms of three phases and how we use story within each of those phases. I just completed about a year-long project with the world's largest women's service organization. There are approximately 900,000 members, primarily in the U.S., but also some across the world, and maybe 20 to 25 staff members. And in the 89-year history of this organization, it attempted to do strategic planning a couple of years ago, and it made a couple of changes, but not any that the organization itself would label as truly breakthrough. So when new leadership came into place, the decision was made to put in place a strategic plan that had a number of breakthrough strategies for the next 5 years attached to it. So the first phase for us was to do some background work, and what I typically do with organizations is help them create a series of questions that they'd like to have answered 5 years out, and that's part of our environmental scanning process. But the place where that information is shared is in a strategic planning retreat. And this organization chose to bring together 50 individuals, which was a vertical slice of the organization, so we had representation of five different generations of individuals, as well as from all different parts of the country and all different work within the organization itself. And we met for 2.5 days. And we again used Gleicher's model, the dissatisfaction vision for steps model, to create the agenda for that meeting. And in the dissatisfaction phase, we used stories in two ways. First of all, people received a binder of articles in advance that were discovered in the process of answering the environmental scan questions. And we went through and talked about each of those different categories of questions and the information. But as we were starting to complete that part of the process, my first question to people individually was, what story is this information telling you about the next 5 years? What is it that you're really hearing? And I did not care if people's stories matched one another. In fact, I really hoped that they did not, because I wanted to hear a dissension. I wanted to hear opinions come out. I wanted to hear surprises. I wanted to hear disappointments. All different sorts of feelings start to get attached to the information, because then I knew that change was starting to take place. Now, what we did after that is we looked out to the year 2025. So we took this huge leap, and we took two of the uncertainties that we had identified, those being the stability of the U.S. economy and terrorism, and we created four different scenarios. So the scenarios were things like local terrorism and prosperity, or local terrorism and a depressed economy, or widespread terrorism and prosperity and widespread terrorism and a depressed economy. And the group of 50 then broke into four different groups, and over the course of several hours, they created a scenario story. And I gave them really no direction other than to say, it could be the day in a life of a particular person, or you could talk to me about how a community is at operation. Now, we did have a scenario question that people were answering, and that question was, how will veterans and their families live their lives in 2025? So they could become a veteran's family. They could become a veteran. They could become a community service agency that serves veterans. They could do whatever they wanted. Now, what I always find fascinating when I have people do scenario stories is at first you see this look of shock on their face.
Like, yeah, I've seen that look.
You want me to do what? And then at the end of a couple of hours, they are so engaged with their story that they don't want to stop working on it. And in fact, even after the groups reported out on their stories, because they had all written them up for distribution and they acted them out kind of, you know, as best as they could in the circumstance, they still continued to work into the evening and the next day on those stories because they were so compelling. But what I always discover with these stories is two things. One is they really create that sense of urgency around the dissatisfaction. The second piece is they start to create what a new future might look like and what the potential breakthrough strategies might be. Now, after we were done with that particular retreat, this organization has a process by which their plan must be approved. But before it can be approved, we had to have a first-year set of action steps around it, which would be what you and I would call first steps.
Okay. Actually, before we go to the first steps, and if this is something you're going to cover in a moment, then just tell me to shut up. That'd be fine. But it sounds like, I mean, I'm very excited at the fact that there were all these different stories and there was dissension implied in them and different views of what the future might bring. So before we moved into first steps, I would think, how does that brought together in, I guess, in a vision or a story that respects the various views?
Well, we actually we do that work together. I have a process that I use with organizations to help them look at their current mission and to decide if any changes need to be made to that. Because I always, for me, a mission statement has to do with what is it that we currently do today and for whom. And obviously, over the course of 89 years, if you haven't looked at that, that may have changed. But we're not changing. Well, it may or it may not. I mean,
No, I understand. Yeah.
You know, the founding upon which the organization is based will never change. But the way in which it carries out its work might, right?
Yeah.
And then we created a vision statement. But what we did not do in the event, because I didn't think that 50 people were sufficient and I wanted to include some new voices, is we did not create a vision story in the event itself. We just created for the first time ever for the organization a new vision. And for me, vision isn't about what the organization wants to become. Vision for this organization was about, in the eyes of our future members, what is it that we need to become? Think about that. That's a very powerful statement.
Mm-hmm.
But we captured, we had so many post-it notes about what all of this means, and we had broken up into small groups to create different variations on the vision based on the scenario work, that we still kept all of that. Now, what we did was when we left that work and we moved into creating first-year plans, we had three breakthrough strategy teams because there were three separate and distinct breakthroughs. The first work that each of those teams did, because it included members from the retreat and new members from all over the country, again, who knew nothing about what we had done, that we had to communicate to them, we created a vision story for each of those breakthroughs. And it was wonderful to do that work. People, again, were a little reticent up front because they're like, well, how do we know what this breakthrough means with our new vision? We don't. And I said, well, let's just dream. And the question that people answered was, 5 years from now, if this breakthrough strategy were fully implemented, how different would the organization be? How would it function? So again, people did some very fascinating stories, and those stories were updated almost every time the team met, and regularly in its follow-up conference calls, people would talk about it. It was never forgotten. And it became a guidepost for them in terms of what is it that we need to become in the future, if, you know, given that here are all the challenges that the organization will be facing as we move forward. And as you and I well know, I think the dilemma that we face anywhere is that while we think we know what the future holds, our opinions and our individual thoughts are never as don't have as much foresight as what actually does occur, that we are very limited through our vision. So we created those vision stories about the years like 2012, 2013, because we were doing this work back in 2007. Now, we still had to get approval from the leadership in the organization, which numbers about 53 individuals, but we didn't just limit going to the 53 of them, and we didn't just give them a report. So what we did in the third phase of this project was we created a real-time strategic change event, which was not very long. And this is important because I want to be able to share with listeners that stories can help you make change happen faster, and it can make it happen in a way that gets people to a result that's important for the organization in a way that brings them together collaboratively. So imagine people meeting on a Saturday from 1 until 6:30 in the evening, and then on a Sunday from 8 until 12. That's all we had. And on the first day, we had to deal with 300 people, many of whom had not heard a thing about the strategy and who were going to vote a few days later on whether or not the strategy and the vision and mission were going to get implemented. They had come to listen. So, again, it was a very diverse group of individuals who were invited to attend a true slice of the organization. And in our dissatisfaction piece, after we did a really cool presentation around what we called startling statements with people that truly were startling, that had questions attached to them, that if you were listening to them for the first time would just make you go, oh, my goodness, I can't believe that's going to happen. And you said that for like 12 or 15 minutes. You know, so you were already like, oh, my gosh, you know, this is pretty serious. And then you go and you do an activity. And then we came back and we said to you, we're going to have you listen to stories from six people Three of those are going to be your former leaders, and three are going to be critical members of the organization. Each of those individuals shared a four-minute story. Now, the people who were former leaders shared a story around a challenge I faced as president that's still a challenge today.
Hmm.
And those who were not presidents but were key leaders today shared a story around what experience has made me question my membership. Now, we did not let people spontaneously tell their stories. What we did was a member of a design team and I would prep people by email, and then we would call them and we would audio tape what they wanted to say. And those audio tapes were anywhere from 30 minutes to an hour in length. Then from there, using the story structure I shared earlier in our conversation today, I took their stories and reduced them to a four-minute story and came up with what I thought was the key point of that story, given what the person had told us in their interview, as well as where the content seemed to go, because sometimes you just have to let information take you where it needs to go. And those six stories were then shared with individuals, and they were allowed to process them back at table groups. And they were all, people were quiet. You could have heard pins drop during every single story.
Wow.
It was really remarkable. And then what we did that I think was really cool is that when we were transitioning from dissatisfaction to talking about vision, I had talked to the president of the organization in advance, and I asked her to share the following story. And this was her prompt. I said, tell me about a time in your life where you really strongly resisted a change, and when you came to accept it, you found it had many benefits. And again, she had shared that story with me when I'd first met her. So it wasn't a new story to me, but I still captured it by audio tape and then turned it into the story that she used as her transition to the audience. Because if you think about it, if there's something that you really strongly resist, which audience members may have been doing at that part of our meeting already, even though they had heard things that were quite urgent, they still don't have to do anything about them.
Right.
But what she was saying was, hey, folks, I survived.
Yeah.
Yeah, and not only did I survive, but, hey, there were some really cool benefits. And the losses I thought were going to happen didn't happen,
yeah.
And so please join me. So it became a metaphor for us going forward. And then what we did in the vision section that was just really cool, coming back to an earlier question that you had, As you so aptly stated, we didn't have a story around the organization's full vision. We only had stories around each of its breakthroughs.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did was we took the next 3 years of incoming leaders, and they did a story called We Have a Dream.
Huh.
And they did it in the form of a diary. So they were on stage, all three of them journal. So one journal's in bed, one journal's in a chair, one journal's at a desk, and that's where they were seated.
Is that right? I mean, there was a bed on stage.
There was a bed. Oh, absolutely.
Oh, I love it. This is great.
Else too. And they, together, because we wanted to show unity and collaboration, they created their story of what they felt the future would be like.
Huh.
And they did it to the point where, as one was maybe midway through a sentence, the next one would pick up mid-sentence and continue it.
Hmm.
It was just beautifully orchestrated. And then we followed that up immediately with skits around those three breakthrough stories, where each of those three teams actually acted out on stage what the future would look like for people, because we wanted them to experience the future, not see it.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted them to live it and breathe it in that moment.
So they embodied the story.
You bet they did. So they had four stories, the vision of the organization and the vision of each of the three breakthrough strategies.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last time that we used story in the event, which I think is one of the coolest things that a group has ever done, is one of the members of the organization has a nephew who's a songwriter, and he created a song for us.
Huh.
That was a story that brought the entire event to a conclusion. And I can tell you that even before that song was given to people, which was around 11:30 on the second day of their event, we already had audience members who were standing up and declaring to everyone in the room that they had come as a skeptic, that they had started out as a skeptic, and they had come to embrace what we were asking them to embrace.
They were doing this on their own.
Yes. Well, we had pieces that we had built in, like at the beginning of the second morning, where it's a very high risk. We ask on the evaluation form the night before for questions you would like to have answered. And then the next morning we create a panel where the panel answers those questions, and then we open it up to questions from the floor, unknown questions from the floor.
Yeah.
And that's when we started to hear, which was probably about 9 o'clock on the second morning, we were already hearing that people had had a huge shift.
Wow.
And the big cool thing about it is that there were two meetings for the leadership of this organization to approve different aspects of the plan, and both of those meetings came out with positive outcomes and in a shorter period of time than had been anticipated.
Wow, in a shorter period of time. You don't hear that much these days.
Well, you know, I always think for myself as a strategist and consultant that it's our job to find ways to help organizations make change happen quickly. And I think that what I've learned over the past several years is that story can help us to do that.
Yeah.
And story in a variety of different forms.
Yeah, I'm with you. I believe you. I wanted to ask one thing. I really appreciated the depth of the story and how story of one, the depth of the story you told, but also how story was used in various different settings, you know, with various stakeholders. And I thought that it gave a much richer picture than, okay, I've got this one meeting, how do I tell a story for that meeting? But that it's so integral to the whole process. Two things. One is you mentioned real-time strategic change, and I'm assuming that you're talking about the process that Jake Jacobs came up with.
Right. I learned that process directly through Kathy Dannemiller.
Okay.
I have come to modify and adapt that approach over time to allow my clients flexibility in how that model plays out.
Okay. So let me just make a comment then for anybody listening who's not familiar with that. Robert Jacobs, Jake, was a partner with Dannemiller and Tyson Associates, and he came out with a book called Real-Time Strategic Change, and then Dannemiller Tyson's came out with a book, which I think is called Whole-Scale Change. And actually, I would say read both.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it has to be a doctrinaire approach, but if you're not used to running a meeting for 300 to 500 people that's interactive and gets people engaged kind of fully, you're in for a treat and a surprise. And So I was glad to hear that. I just wanted to make sure that the listeners, you know, knew what you were referring to. So my other question, though, is, so any idea where things stand now with the organization you were talking about?
They're moving forward with their plans. I have since left the process since I don't get involved in the details of the implementation of the first year plans. But they're beginning to move forward with their implementation.
Super. That's great.
Absolutely super, because as you and I well know, where things tend to stop is in implementation.
Yep.
You know, is that the plan goes on the shelf and people get paralysis and nothing new gets done, but that has not occurred with this organization.
Huh. That's wonderful. Great. Well, we're about out of time, and I want to give you a couple minutes or a few minutes just to talk about you and the work that you do and how people could get in touch with you, and if you want to say, you know, a word or two about a couple of the books, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I'm actually a business strategist, so I work with organizations on creating long-range plans or on doing scenario work or what people call futuring work. Along with that, I tend to get involved, as you've heard through the example, in large-scale changes to help to implement the ideas and the breakthroughs that people would like to have in place and to go forward with their organizations. What I also do is I love being on the edge of what I call a bleeding edge thinking, which is what got me involved in stories. So over the years, I've authored two books. The first one, Stories Trainers Tell, I co-authored with Mary Wacker. And this book has two really lovely pieces to it. The first half of the book covers where do you find stories, how do you craft them, how might you use them in presentations, what are some general tips on telling, and then the legal and ethical issues of using stories that are not your own. And that's a fairly significant piece that we don't want to leave out of using stories in organizations. And then the rest of the book has 55 stories that people have given us permission to have others use in their organizations and training modules around it. And some of those stories have to do with organizational change. The second book, which I wrote, Wake Me Up When the Data is Over, came as a result of going out and doing radio and TV shows. And all the hosts would say to me, can't stories be applied to something more than training? My response was yes, and here's an example from my work, but no one at the time back in 2003 had really written any examples. So what I spearheaded was a 3-year research project where we went out to look for fresh new examples from organizations using stories in myriad business functions, from organizational change to leadership to customer service to finance, which had never been written about before, to project management and so on. And in each of the chapters, there are 5 distinct examples of the use of story and the tangible business results that followed from each of them. And then along with that, both of those books have websites attached to them. The website, sayitwithastory.com, actually offers 3 of the Stories Trainers Tell stories each month to people who want to come to the website or sign up for our newsletter. And then Wake Me Up When the Data is Over, that book has a website called wakeupmycompany.com. And on it, there are a slew of free articles that you can download to talk to others about the use of story, whether it be in employee engagement or what does the structure of story mean or what sorts of tips should I keep in mind when I'm using stories, things like that.
Terrific. And if somebody wanted to contact you, should they do it through the website or do you want to give any other information?
Sure. There are a couple of ways that people can reach me. They can reach me on my 800 number, which is 800-253-6398. Now, they can also email me through a direct email address, which is P like in Peter, F like in Frank, the word progress at AOL.com, or they can go through one of our websites. Both of those are wonderful ways to reach me.
Super. Great. Well, Lori, thank you so much. This has been a very helpful podcast, certainly for me, and I would guess for the people who are going to be listening to this.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to share with people what the power of story really can do in organizational change.
Sure thing. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.